Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, next week is Congo Week, a time to consider the United States' role in the death of 6 million Africans in the past decade and a half. We'll speak with the executive director of the Friends of Congo.
But first, last Thursday was a day of action in defense of public education, with demonstrations in cities across the country. One of the largest actions took place in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we caught up with Shante Driver, national chairperson of BAM, By Any Means Necessary.
It's probably the highest point of action in the country, and that BAM was very centrally involved in and instrumental to, was at the University of California, Berkeley, where thousands of students and professors and workers from the campus came together, rallied, and then marched, and then occupied about 1,000 people, occupied the library for many, many, many hours, and held a General Assembly meeting, took a vote on a series of actions that carry us right through the middle of November. And that was, I think that was really probably the most successful day of action. We were joined by students that marched from Laney College in Oakland and high school and other community colleges from all across the Bay Area that came to be a part of that day of action.
Action in pursuit of what?
I think in pursuit of, first, just a defense of public education, both from pre-K through 12 and also in higher education. But I would also say that there is a real spirit of defending the movement, of the need to be building an independent movement. And when for me, being at the Berkeley campus and being a part of the occupation and the rally and all of that, what really came across to me was how many of the people who were involved because they believe in fighting on an independent basis to preserve the living standards of the workers at the University of California, the professors, the graduate students. There's a very large degree of pro-union sentiment. And I think that the issues that have been most important to BAM were much more front and center this year in this fall action than they were last year at UC Berkeley, which is, you know, doubling the number of underrepresented minority students on the campus, of Latino, Black, Native American, and Filipino students, ending the resegregation of higher education, opening up the institution to look more like the state of California, and passage of the DREAM Act and comprehensive immigrant rights reforms. There is a real sense that the people who were marching, a number of whom, come from relatively comfortable and privileged lives, really want a different society, and didn't feel like they were going to get that by either putting their energies into supporting the Democrats or the Republicans at this point. But we're only going to attain that through their own independent action. It's a very, very integrated, diverse crowd, and there was really a sense of we're out here to let the nation know, our movement isn't going to die, even if there aren't specific attacks being made against higher education this year in the California budget.
These actions were held all across the country in defense of public education. But in defense against whom? Who are these forces arrayed against public education?
There were events held in over 25 states, and BAM was involved in events in many, many other states. And I think in most places, the day of action was seen as defending against really Arne Duncan and the move to charterize education, to berate and belittle teachers, to break up the teachers' union, and to create a new system of privatized, charterized education, starting with the inner cities and then extending beyond that. And I know in a number of places there were people who were reflecting on the fact that while we were out there protesting to defend public education at every level, the Obama administration was meeting at the White House with a bunch of private funders and community college people to try to create a Race for the Top program for community colleges that gives the private sector far more control over community college education than they've ever had. And that is an attempt to mirror the privatization of K through 12 education that both the Republicans and the Democrats are now championing. And I think there's just a sense of, okay, there are two forces lined up. There's the mass of people that believe in the great democratic gain of public education, know it's a civil rights issue, are fighting tooth and nail to defend it. And on the other side, there's kind of both of the two political parties. They're all the wealthiest people in America, and they are looking at taking away this fundamental democratic gain and replacing it with a system in which a tiny oligarchy of people who happen to be billionaires get to make the decisions over what kind of education the youth of America receive. And I think there's almost everywhere a sense that the attacks are coming from both political parties and are really being led by Arne Duncan, the Department of Education Secretary. And it was a very common demand in place after place after place that Arne Duncan needs to go, and that that we don't need more charters, and that the attacks on public education need to stop, and that if those billionaires want to donate money to education, they ought to do it through increased taxes so that it can be the decision of the public what kind of education is being provided for the youth of this nation, not the individual decisions of Emperor Bill Gates or Emperor Warren Buffett or anybody else.
And in that spirit, and I'm looking at some of your literature here now, you urge people to embrace open conflict and social upheaval and always speak to and for the oppressed.
We've been quoting the I Have a Dream speech to make clear that was the spirit of the old civil rights movement, that speech, which I think is one of the greatest speeches in American history and probably the greatest speech of the 20th century, is not a speech of passivity. It's a speech in which Dr. King has said, we're tired of the Bank of Justice being closed to us, and, you know, this is not a time to accept the drug of gradualism. This is a time to be organizing and fighting for what we need. And he says very explicitly in that speech, white America, know this to be true. The struggle that's opened won't stop until justice is done. And I, as a black leader, am not going to be trying to shut down that struggle. And I can't, and I won't. I stand with the people who are fighting for their equality. And And that's the spirit that I think we are trying to get young people to embrace again, because I think it's so oppressive for so many young people now, because they feel like just being themselves, speaking the plain truth about racism, fighting the new Jim Crow, is something that is just decried by all of the media, by again, both of the two political parties, and they want to see a change. They feel angry. They feel shortchanged. And we think that that anger should be organized into a productive, positive social movement, fighting for a real set of demands, rather than expressed in the violence that, that we see every day in our communities that can lead to no good.
BAM hosts its national conference next month at the University of California at Berkeley.
The forces of school corporatization suffered a setback at the hands of voters in Washington, D.C. last month. Mayor Adrian Fenty went down to defeat in a Democratic primary election. Most observers believe Fenty was dragged down by voter rejection of his school's chief, Michelle Rhee, the highly abrasive nemesis of teachers' unions, who's expected to be fired by the new mayor. Lee Dingerson is a Washington community activist and parent of two children in the D.C. public schools. She's also author of an article in the magazine Rethinking Schools, in which she criticizes the corporate education model espoused by Michelle Rhee and the Obama administration.
I think that the latest high-profile education reform movement has been a movement that is sort of largely trying to track a very corporate model for the organization and delivery of school systems and education. And I think that's a little problematic when you're talking about an institution that serves both communities and children. I don't think that model really suits for public education. Privatization is a part of that agenda. I don't think everyone within the school reform movement shares that, but I certainly think it's a part of it.
It seemed that Michelle Rhee became a focal point for opposition to the Fenty administration in general.
Yes, she did. And I don't want to suggest that families and parents and teachers in Washington don't believe that there need to be some pretty fundamental changes in the D.C. public schools. I've got two kids in the D.C. public school system. We've been in the system for 12 years now. I think I and most other parents in the city would agree that reform is needed desperately. So when Adrian Fenty took over the schools and Michelle Rhee was appointed as chancellor, I think a lot of us were sort of hopeful that maybe things would start getting done. And things did start getting done, but very quickly the tenor and the tone of reform turned people off. And just over the last year, I think more and more folks have gotten frustrated with the way that Michelle Rhee has shut out communities and has focused her attacks and humiliation so heavily on the teaching workforce. And I think that kind of did her in and did Adrian Fenty in during the September primaries.
So what is the difference between genuine reform, in your view, and reform, R-H-E-E, form?
Well, again, I think that what Chancellor Rhee focused on were structures and teachers. She did not offer any kind of initiative that would change instructional practices. She did not address teaching and learning issues. It really became much more of a gotcha system, a way to judge and sweep the deck clear of teachers that she felt were underperforming. And I have to say that I think a lot of the teachers that got swept out in that series of firings certainly included some underperformers, but also included some teachers that, you know, have been doing good things in the classroom. What we need for education reform in Washington is we need a comprehensive focus on the conditions in the schools that create institutions and buildings where children can learn and want to learn, and where teachers can teach and want to teach and can grow in their professions, not constantly be feeling judged and humiliated and disrespected.
But, of course, Ree is the poster child for what the corporate forces consider to be school reform. Oprah is recommending her for the next school's chief of Newark, New Jersey, where Mayor Cory Booker has just received a $100 million gift from the Facebook owner to revamp the schools. Does Ree really personify what the Walton family of Walmart fame and others want the schools to look like?
I think she does personify that that movement of education reformers. I unfortunately do not think that that strategy for reform, this corporatization of the educational process, is good for America. I don't think it's good for our children. I think our kids and our communities need public education institutions that focus on learning, that focus on the breadth and creativity and the depth of curriculum and experiences, you know, that really make our students into civic beings. And I just don't think that the reform model that Chancellor Ree personifies and that Oprah is promoting is a reform model that is the best one for our kids.
And did Michelle Ree ultimately become an albatross around Mayor Fenty's neck?
Absolutely. The reason that I wrote the article for Rethinking Schools was that I felt that Chancellor Ree had gotten so much exposure in the national media and with Oprah and Time Magazine and Newsweek and Waiting for Superman, but there was no opportunity in all of that national media work for the voices of parents and teachers to be heard. And for anyone, you know, nobody asked how these reforms were being experienced on the ground and in the schools. And that's why I wrote the article. And I think it really was summed up well by Diane Ravitch, as I say in the article, that you can't win a war when you're firing on your own troops. And that's the way that Chancellor Ree's reforms have been experienced by teachers and parents in Washington.
Does Michelle Ree represent the Obama administration's approach to reform in the public schools?
That's a more nuanced question. In some ways, she does. I think the Obama administration has embraced some of the components of the corporate reform agenda. I don't think that the tenor and the tone of reform that the chancellor brought to D.C. is at all what the Obama administration was expecting. I think that, you know, unfortunately, though she is now a spokesperson for the movement, I think there are a lot of folks within that movement who are cringing at sort of the way in which she has done what she's done in D.C. I think that that the negativity and the disrespect for teachers does not necessarily have to be part of that movement, even though I don't agree with the basic tenets of the movement anyway.
You seem to be saying that stylistically the corporatizers may have a problem with Michelle Ree, but that substantively she and they are one.
I actually think that's a good way of putting it. I think stylistically there have been some differences, even among the corporate reformers, with Chancellor Ree. But in terms of the programs that she's implemented and the way that she's gone about the changes, the so-called changes, I think there's a lot of agreement.
Next week is Congo Week, a time to remind the world that an estimated 6 million people have died in the Democratic Republic of Congo since 1996. The invasion of eastern Congo by the armed forces of Rwanda and Uganda, two staunch U.S. allies in the region, is the main cause of the genocide and the subject of a United Nations report officially released this month. According to the report, the Rwandan Tutsi military slaughter of Hutus in Congo may constitute genocide. We ask Friends of Congo Executive Director Maurice Carney if his organization had submitted comments to the United Nations.
Yes, we certainly have commented, and we've made a few statements clear. One, the UN mapping report that was published on October 1 of this year by the UN Commission for Human Rights is not new. The contents are the same, in at least in the core elements, that the United Nations study did in 1997-1998. The Garrettin Report was done by Roberto Garrettin. However, during that time when Garrettin did his report, it was suppressed by members of the Security Council, in particular the United States and Great Britain, because the report was so damning and implicated the U.S.'s staunchest ally in Central Africa, Paul Kagame, of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So the report that came out in 2010 really is just we're at a stage where the United Nations could officially put its stamp on the crimes that have been committed by Rwanda in Central Africa. So that's one thing that we made clear, that it's not new, and that the report, the elements of the core elements of the report have been published in 1997-1998. Secondly, the report confirmed what Congolese have been calling for the last 14 years, and that is one thing, justice. That's what they've been calling for, justice, not only against, not only justice at the local level, but also justice at the international level. Because it was in 2008 that Antonio Guterres, the UN Chief High Commissioner for Refugees, in an interview that he gave to the Financial Times, clearly stated, he said, let us not forget that the international community has systematically looted the Congo. So the Congolese people are calling for justice at the local level and also at the international level. So that's a second statement that Friends of the Congo has come up with. And in line with justice, we believe that an international tribunal ought to be set up to try those who have committed crimes against humanity, those who have committed war crimes, and those who have committed atrocities and possibly genocide in the Congo, but not also those crimes against humanity. But in addition to that, we need to look at the corporations that have been complicit in these crimes that have been committed in the Congo. And there's an entire section in the UN report that talks about reparations, and it states clearly that the Congolese people are entitled to reparations from those multinational corporations that were complicit or identified as illegally looting Congo's wealth during the period of war. So those are the stances that Friends of Congo has taken, and in calling people of conscience throughout the globe to stand on the side of the Congolese people in calling for justice, especially considering that we're talking about the greatest crimes that have been committed at the dawn of the 21st century. We just cannot overstate this, where we have an estimated 6 million dead black people in the heart of Africa, yet the world has been silent and justice has been denied. So there should be a global outcry from all people of conscience saying that the Congolese people must get justice now.
Now, if the United States, as you say, was key to blocking these reports that are only now coming out about massacres in Congo by Rwandan troops, if they were key to blocking those reports years ago, why would they allow this report now to surface?
Well, I mean, if you know anything about U.S. foreign policy, they have what you call allies of convenience. So when an ally is convenient to the United States, they'll protect that ally, they'll use that ally, and they will run interference, just as they have done for Israel over the years. But once they're through with you or do not find you as useful, then they would let, you know, they'll let the dogs in at you, so to speak. We saw that with Mobutu. They protected Mobutu for over three decades. But at the end of the 1990s, Bill Richardson, who was the UN representative in the Clinton administration, went into Mobutu and said to Mobutu, hey, it's time to go. You know, that's literally what he said. We have him on film acknowledging that, that he went in and said it's time to go. So that's what the U.S. does. It lets you know that it stops protecting its allies if it's no longer convenient for them to do so. So Kagame, who still carries out U.S. interests in the region, he's becoming a liability because of his repressive practices in the region, because of the overwhelming evidence that's coming out. We have a Spanish court that has international arrest warrants against him, against 40 of his top officials. They would actually have it against him, but they can't do it against the head of state. We have a situation where people within his own ranks of the Rwandan Patriotic Front are jumping ship. So there is instability there and some uncertainty there, and the U.S. is obviously stepping back a little bit. And we have a situation where President Obama may not be as inclined as President Clinton and President Bush to stand by Kagame. So those are some of the reasons why we may see a little bit of opening. Don't get me wrong, the U.S. is still behind Kagame, but not as strongly as the Bush and Clinton administrations were. And now we have a law that's on the books. It's called the Obama Law. It's the one law that he has his name on when he was a senator, Public Law 109-456, which says that the Secretary of State has the authority to withhold aid from any foreign country or neighbor that destabilizes the Congo. And Rwanda has been the prime destabilizer of the Congo. However, that law has not been enforced. If we see the U.S. start to enforce that law, Secretary Clinton, who co-sponsored the bill that turned into law, Obama sponsored the law, the bill, and Clinton co-sponsored it. If we see them start to enforce that, then we know for sure that they're through with Kagame. But he's still hanging in there with them, but they've given some space for reports such as what we saw in October being published by the United Nations.
And yet, as you said, Rwanda and Uganda have been the main U.S. allies in Central Africa. They together are the cat's paws of U.S. foreign policy. Who would they get to replace Rwanda and, by extension, Uganda, which has also been implicated in atrocities in Congo?
Now, that's an excellent question. Who would they get to replace? You know, Rwanda, you have to remember the question really for Obama. You have to remember that Obama is carrying on the legacy of Clinton's Renaissance leaders. He identified, the Madeleine Albright at the time, identified Paul Kagame, Yoweri Museveni, Meles Zenawi, and I think even Afrika of Eritrea as the Renaissance leaders of Africa. And these, one thing that these leaders have in common, especially Kagame and Museveni, is that they've invaded another African country, and they have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands. So what we see from Obama is a slight shift from that. And what we're doing, we're calling on Obama, is to stand by his own words that he first stated in July of 2009 in his Ghana speech, where he said that the U.S. Needs to adopt a stance where they support strong institutions and not strong men. He repeated that again at the United Nations in this year in the U.N. speech, where he put that principle out there, strong institutions and not strong men, which was a sign that he's looking to distance himself from Kagame and other strong men in the region. And distance himself from Clinton administration and later Bush administration policies. Now, what we're looking at is Obama actually understanding that they don't need strong men. If the U.S. interests can be served if they support the people. And that's what I shouldn't say we're betting on, but that's what we're pushing Obama to adhere to his words, where he stand on the side of justice, where he stand on the side of the people, where he stand on the side of democracy. So we're holding up those words for him, and with expectation that he would actually hold to his own words.
Other observers have a more cynical interpretation of events. They say that the United States allowed the release of that report as a kind of pressure against Rwanda and possibly Uganda not to get too close to China.
That's a valid concern, and I think a valid assessment. And what we're saying is we should take that opportunity to continue to drive the point home that we saw how the U.S. dealt with Congo, for example, when it looked to get too close to China. It dealt with the Congo in a more gangster fashion. In fact, the Chinese stated in to the Financial Times that felt that the West was blackmailing the Congo. But when Congo established that $9 billion deal with China, where they're swapping minerals for infrastructure, and the Congolese would give the Chinese cobalt and copper, and in return, the Chinese would build roads, schools, hospitals, clinics, you name it. And that was a $9 billion deal, and the International Monetary Fund stepped in and said, hey, you know, this deal is a no-go, because what it's going to do is add to your debt. That's what he's saying to the Congolese government, and we want you to cut this back. In addition to that, if you do not cut this deal back, we won't retire the $11 billion debt that we have over your head, and we won't fund your government to the tune of $600 million, which you need to operate. So the Congolese government had to step back, had to accede to the calls by the International Monetary Fund, renegotiate the deal. So there is a Chinese element in there as well. But if that Chinese element is there, we see this as an opportunity as activists to take advantage of the opening and push the call for justice. Now, some may say, well, that may be a long shot, or some may say the chances are limited, but we see it as an opportunity nonetheless in order to get the truth out about what's been taking place in the region over the last 14 years. And remember that we're not just talking about Rwanda and Uganda. If Rwanda and Uganda are implicated, that brings into play the United States and Great Britain. The $1 billion that the U.S. has given to Rwanda in aid over the last decade or so, was that $1 billion funding genocide in the Congo? This is a question that Congress people ought to be taking up and having hearings on and talking about. So the Chinese role is critical, but we also see an opportunity not only to get the truth out, but also to hold everybody accountable, or at the very least, share with the American public the chain of command. We have rebels in Congo, Rwanda and Uganda are the point countries in the region, but they're backed up by the United States and Great Britain, and we have to follow the chain all the way to Washington and all the way to London.
The housing crisis that led to Wall Street's meltdown is still raging in black communities across the nation. In Oakland, we met up recently with Robbie Clark, part of a cadre of young organizers with an understanding of both political economy and history. Clark is a member of Just Cause, a group that was originally formed to fight illegal evictions. She says a wave of disinvestment is sweeping across Oakland, causing unprecedented dislocation.
There's a, you know, really big concentrations of foreclosed properties. We're seeing on a massive level most neighborhoods going plummeting in their property values due to vacant properties and due to intensified displacement pressures that already exist in those areas. So there's already been an existing, you know, unemployment and underemployment problem, and so that's continuing and worsening as the economy gets worse. So because of that, we're also seeing people lose their homes due to that as well. So the more empty homes we have, the more blight we have, the less and less, and the more and more the property values go down, so the less property is worth. And so we're seeing a real massive kind of this investment in communities, specifically working class communities of color in Oakland. And we're seeing that the folks that have the resources to buy those properties, to even get loans, are speculators or other real estate companies. There's not a lot of individuals who are able to get loans now. Banks aren't lending to individuals. So the people who are the entities that are buying the properties that are now available are specifically speculators who are looking to flip the properties once the market bounces back. So we're definitely seeing a really vast and wide and very quick period of disinvestment, which I think is a lot different than the way that disinvestment has happened in Oakland over the past few years. Usually it's more of a It usually happens over a longer period of time, but we're seeing that the foreclosure crisis is kind of an immediate wipeout of property value.
Sounds like a kind of disaster capitalism.
Right, exactly. That's how some of our members describe it. They describe the foreclosure crisis as like the economic Katrina, because it's really like wiping out entire communities. It's wiping out the wealth base for Black people specifically, and also for Latino families as well. The specifics of, I mean, in Oakland, more than half of the homeowners who have, more than half of like African American and Latino homeowners have subprime loans. And so you see that it's like specifically a very like racialized crisis, and that the specific wealth and like asset building of communities of color has been just like severely devastated by this crisis. I mean, for Black people, you know, for over 60% of Black people, our main assets are our homes. And so this crisis really is having a real significant effect on Black wealth, particularly.
You seem to be saying that Black folks are losing their hold, their roots and anchor in Oakland.
That's something that's happening, like not just in Oakland, but also in a lot of, you know, post-industrial working class cities. We're seeing that, you know, Black people are being uprooted. I mean, I feel like it's something that's happened in history like many times. I think that within this kind of newer urban context and this more kind of in this period where a lot of people would want to believe that racism is over, and because we have a Black president that things are different, that, you know, it's a real slap in the face in terms of the reality of race and what race has meant in the United States. I mean, no matter how far people think we've come, the fact of the matter is that still, as a Black person, your ability to obtain wealth and to pass that wealth on to future generations is still being inhibited by capitalism. Like no matter what, like capitalism continues to break apart our families and social networks. I mean, it started when we were brought to this country, continued through racist policies in the Jim Crow South that led people to migrate to different parts of the United States to escape racism, and it continues once we move into these post-industrial cities where different, you know, laws and policies of local entities and of banks and whatnot have made it so that we can't live in certain neighborhoods, or we can't get money to live in certain neighborhoods. So there's a lot of structural, you know, racism that has led to those things. So what we're seeing is that, you know, Black people and people of color in general, I think it's a part of a more of a global displacement narrative, but people of color in general, are where we live and where we're able to establish roots is always connected to finance. And it's always connected to the movement of capital, and it's always being held by the same folks that hold the purse strings.
We know your group, Just Cause, does studies of the underlying economic situation in Oakland. But what do you push in terms of action?
Most of the action, or a lot of the action that we take, so as Causa Justa, Just Cause, we actually just merged with the organization in San Francisco. So we work in both Oakland and in San Francisco on, one, providing direct services for folks so people know their rights and aren't illegally pushed out of their homes. Another specific campaign that we're taking up now is our Utilities On campaign, which is fighting to keep utilities on for tenants in Oakland and San Francisco. And making sure that utility shutoffs and habitability issues are not used as illegal eviction methods, because folks have, because tenants have the right to stay in their homes past eviction in both Oakland and in San Francisco. So most of our work has been on really pushing for a lot of the banks to be held accountable to be good landlords and to paying the utilities bills. And we're really focused on making sure that people are able to stay in their homes. We feel like if we're able to make sure that folks are able to stay in their homes, if we're able to build up and to continue to foster community ties, if we're and our work also includes us getting people more like civically engaged and just getting people a lot more engaged and involved in what goes on in this city, so that way we can make sure that people can fight to stay here, and then once we're able to hold a significant block of people here, then we'll have the political power to shift the political will of our city council and of our mayors and implement policies that will improve you know, the lives of folks all throughout Oakland. Really specifically, we're looking at policies of investment that will that will be community-driven investment. That's really what longer term what we would like to see. We'd like to see more participation of the community in the budgeting process in terms of setting the city budget, so that way the services and needs of the community are first rather than the interests of developers and other people who are just trying to make money off of the city. So what we're trying to do is really build up the political power and really push for there to be actual democracy at a local level that includes the participation of communities within making the decisions around how a city spends its money and what a city's priorities are.
You've said that Oakland seems to be becoming a playground for white people, and you're going to resist that.
There's a few different types of people and a few different types of responses. For a long time, there have been the developer interests in Oakland who whose main line around things is just around like community improvement, and people like to use crime and the crime in Oakland as an excuse for the need of community improvement and redevelopment and all these different things. And especially, we like to use it as an excuse to put more money into police and police services, and so that's what a lot of the push has been, and we've seen in neighborhoods that once they start to, you know, build like these new condos, or once you see that there's a lot of speculators who have been able to buy a lot of empty homes in a certain area, there is an increased police presence. You see, you know, you just start to see some of the different shifts in the neighborhood. And then there's also some folks who are white folks that come into the neighborhoods and who see themselves who would like to not see themselves as part of gentrification, who are we actually do get a lot of folks that are like, you know, I don't want to be a gentrifier, like where should I move in Oakland, or, you know, like sometimes people actually ask us those questions. And then there are some people who are just simply like, well, this is where, you know, it's more affordable. for me to live. And so there's a number of various responses. I think that the response to us that is the most troubling is the response or the lack of response of the city government in terms of like our city council and in terms of our mayor, who don't see the need to actually invest in communities. Like, they see the need of investing in other profit-making ventures, but they don't see the benefit of putting money into communities to benefit the people who live there now. Oftentimes, the council and the council members and the mayor are most interested in the voices of people who have been either people who are mostly like middle class, because that's who votes the most, or people who are like small business owners. So they tend to listen to those interests more than they listen to the working class interests of people in Oakland, and you know, we're the majority of the people who live in Oakland. So it's a significant problem. And so I think that their response or their lack of response is the most troubling response in this work.
And your mayor is?
Ron Dellums.
The former black congressman.
Yes.
Considered by some to be very progressive at that time.
Right, definitely. Definitely. And I think that there was there was a hope from many of us, and there are many of us who've worked with various organizations and who worked on that campaign or who were a part of the effort to push for Ron Dellums to run. And I definitely think that, you know, and as an organization, we're definitely like supportive of, you know, people of color being in leadership positions. But we're also wanting to see that when people of color get into those leadership positions, that they're acting on behalf of the interests of people of color. And that's not something that we've seen with Ron Dellums.
October 30th marks the anniversary of the capture of Nat Turner, who led a slave revolt that killed 56 whites in 1831. 18 other black freedom fighters were hanged along with Nat Turner, and marauding whites later killed hundreds of black slaves in revenge for the rebellion. The legacy of Nat Turner's rebellion lives on in Southampton County, Virginia, nourished by Mr. Khalif Khalifa, the senior tour guide on the Nat Turner Trail.
The trail consists of the places back in 1831 that Nat Turner's army visited, you know, the slave plantations that own chattel property, including captive African people. So the trail is just a revisit to those places along the route, the same route that Nat Turner's army traveled during the campaign on their way to a place called Jerusalem. So what we have done is found some of the structures that are still standing from the old plantation places, and then we know some of the spots where the structures stood at one time. So that's basically what it is. And the trail is staged from a place on a farm. I bought a 123-acre farm, a working farm down in Southampton County, which is part of the plantation land, or the birth land of Nat Turner. So we go there, and on that place we have a library that's being instituted as the Nat Turner Library. I have a collection of Nat Turner's books, and so people help themselves. We go into town hall type meetings and round table discussions after we do the tour to try to determine the meaning of Nat Turner to the liberation struggle of African people in 2010.
Have you been getting a lot of good traffic coming through on the trail tour?
I've been getting good traffic over the years, and we haven't really since I retired just in this year. So now I'm about to start really promoting it. But it's a well-known path. It was just called the Nat Turner Trail once we found out where that how close the land that I purchased was from some of those actual structures. But we've had people, we had Les Brown, a film crew from Les Brown, who's doing a major play on that Turner. So he had his crew down there on the last one we took in August. So we have some people who come on an annual basis. There's a group in Maryland that comes down on a bus each year. And there's another place in Philadelphia who does a Nat Turner Day on the anniversary of the revolt. So the word is getting out on it. And just recently, there's also a white group in the area, the Southampton County Historical Society, that was founded by one of the living descendants of the victims of Nat Turner. This guy's family survived because a male member wasn't home, and he belly aches about that. But what they have gotten, they got a grant. They just received a grant, a $500,000 grant to develop that tool. They don't want to call it a trail because I branded that so nicely, but they call it the Nat Turner Tour, and they see a way to generate some tourist business because people come down there informally a lot of time. I have people call me all the time asking me, where's the Nat Turner Trail? So, you know, the word is out that Nat Turner enjoys a particular kind of great history and estimation for our people because of his physical resistance to slavery. And he was such a magnificent man. He was a powerful man. He was a charismatic man who did something that became a worldwide incident back then in 1831. He was so powerful that he overcame his own fear and was able to induce others to overcome their own fear as chattel slaves, overcome all the cruelty that was visited on black people as chattel property, to rise up and kill the slave master, a slave owner, and march as an idea to try to liberate black people. So he was a powerful man, a powerful man.
So you're telling us that the descendants of the white casualties of Nat Turner's revolt got a $500,000 grant, but the Nat Turner Trail that celebrates the revolt itself, of course, gets no money.
Yes. Well, I went to see the politician in the area, and he said that we would have to write our own proposal to do that. And since I don't know anything about nonprofit, I've been in business for 40 years, but I never got any grant money and stuff like that. But I do have some people now who are coming down who say they know how to write these proposals. So if anyone on your network know any good proposal writers, of course, you know, I would be willing to talk to them about it. But we are going to put in for our own grant money because we know that one of the things I'm committed to doing is telling the side of Nat Turner that we can't even expect people who don't see Nat Turner in the same light as we to tell the history of Nat Turner.
So, if people want to get in touch with you and to be of use possibly in getting that grant written, how should they contact you?
So my phone number, my telephone number is 434-378-2140. If they want some information about Nat Turner and the Nat Turner Trail and what we're doing, they can go to natturnertrail.com, natturnertrail.com.
And now we come to the most exciting part of today's program. That's the part where Nellie Bailey takes off her co-host hat and speaks as executive director of the Harlem Tenants Council, which is holding next week, for October 15th and Saturday, October 16th, its annual housing conference. That'll be at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, in New York City. And the theme is, we demand housing as a basic human right.
I'm going to ask you, Nellie, is that a right recognized in the United States of America?
No, it is not. As a matter of fact, there are a coalition of activist groups, public policy people, and including lawyers who have submitted a proposal to the UN, but rather a demand to the UN that, in fact, the Obama administration recognizes the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the UN signed on, that the U.S. rather signed on to in 1948, but yet even today we do not have the United States recognizing housing as a basic human right. And that is the demand that we are making at this conference. And let me just say, we have taken a theme from Frederick Douglass, who uttered these words on August 4th, 1857. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. And so the thrust of this conference is that we must make demands on government, and particularly the Obama administration.
You know, there are plenty of housing conferences in a big city like New York. They usually involve the nuts and bolts of things like signing a lease and how you get a mortgage. But you've put together something much, much more comprehensive.
Well, we are going to cover those basic rights of tenants, but in addition, and what is even more important, is that we're looking at a comprehensive housing conference that really recognizes the fact that we are all in the same boat, and that housing intersects with health, education, welfare, the prison industrial complex, and of course jobs. So we have taken a comprehensive approach, but most importantly, and I might add to our for our listeners, that my co-host Glenn Ford will deliver the keynote, because what we are going to talk about is the crisis of capitalism and its unrelenting assaults against the working class. And we are going to have a conference that will hold no punches about the crisis that we are in. And we encourage everyone to visit our website, harlemtenantscouncil.org, or you can contact us by email at harlemtenants, and that's T-E-N-A-N-T-S, at gmail.com, or you can call us at 646-812-5188. We have to really take on the crisis of capitalism, and we want you all to join us.
Well, that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. It's produced by the same team that brings you BlackAgendaReport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.